Welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Happy holidays, and if I haven't said it lately, thank you again for listening to Word Balloon. This is the Christmas and New Year week, so I wanted to take advantage of that and throw up some more content for the end of the year. This episode of Word Balloon has nothing to do with comics, but has a lot to do with three of my favorite subjects, those being old movies, mob stories, and, of course, boxing. Back in my days at Sporting News Radio, I put together a three-part feature that was heard on the air and on the web that talked about a very specific instance back in the 1930s about two heavyweight fighters that met each other both on screen and in the ring. And then later, their story was retold featuring some great writers, directors, and actors. There's some great interview highlights in here featuring some of my favorite people, Bert Sugar, the editor-publisher of Boxing Illustrated and former editor of Ring Magazine, Bud Schulberg, the Academy Award-winning screenwriter of On the Waterfront, The Harder They Fall, and many other films, and several novels and great articles as well. And believe it or not, one of the co-stars of the Beverly Hillbillies. I'll leave that mystery for you until he makes his appearance in the program. So without further ado, let's take a look back at the 30s, 40s, and 50s. A little story about Hollywood, the mob, and boxing from Word Balloon.
Have you seen the remake of Ocean's 11 starring George Clooney, Brad Pitt, and a bunch of other beefcake? Don't worry, I'm not going to spoil the ending for you. But there's an interesting cameo that has to do with the sport of boxing. In the film, there's a little scene that takes place at a Las Vegas fight where then-heavyweight champion Lennox Lewis is fighting arguably the number one heavyweight contender, Vladimir Klitschko. There's even HBO guys there covering the fight. So basically, we've got the two top heavyweights fighting each other in the ring on film before they actually fight each other for real. First time it ever happened? No. In 1933, MGM released a film called The Prizefighter and the Lady, a forgotten picture starring Myrna Loy, but featuring two very prominent boxers of the time, fight historian Bert Sugar.
In The Prizefighter and the Lady, Max Baer, Myrna Loy is in it, that's the lead. Max Baer is to have a fight with Primo Carnera in the movie. This is while he's number one ranked contender for Primo Carnera's title. And when they face off for the movie scene, which is a boxing scene, Max Baer says, "You're not so tough," and he hits him. And Primo Carnera cowered. And at that point, Max Baer knew when they ultimately fought, he would beat him. He was a good actor in that.
Well, I couldn't stop there with just half the story. I had to find out about Primo Carnera's point of view or Max Baer Sr.'s point of view of The Prizefighter and the Lady. Unfortunately, Primo died in the mid-60s and Max Baer Sr. died in 1959. So if I couldn't talk to Max Baer Sr., maybe I could talk to Max Baer Jr. Does the name sound familiar? That's right. Jethro Bodine himself of the Beverly Hillbillies, Max Baer Jr., son of Max Baer, former heavyweight champion of the world. As much as he doesn't mind talking about his Beverly Hillbillies days, Max really enjoys talking about his father, whose ring career and film career were tied together very closely.
My dad played kind of a, I guess you might call it a Rocky type of guy, you know, kid that started out in a bar, and it was almost his life story in a way, strangely enough, up to that point in time. He said that when he made the movie with Carnera, he learned so much about him and how he would try to attack. That was really what the picture helped him with.
As an actor and filmmaker, how would you assess your father's performance in The Prizefighter and the Lady?
He did not have a clue what he was doing, and yet he was very good.
Okay.
When you can take somebody that you could see his, that's the difference, you could see his natural ability because of the fact that he had knew nothing about acting whatsoever.
Okay.
Didn't know anything about a camera, didn't know anything about anything. And yet, he was very good. And it's not just because he's my father, it's just because he was very good. I watched that, and here's a kid, didn't know beans about anything, didn't know anything about movies, didn't know anything except you go to see him. He's all right off the damn farm, and he beats Schmeling, and the next thing you know, he's in a movie. Well, actually, Walter Houston was really directing him in the movie, because Walter Houston played his manager.
Okay.
And Walter would stand off camera and tell my dad, you know, if my dad would do it, and they'd say, print. And if Walter didn't think it was a good one, my dad would say, "Oh, come on, I can do another one, I can do another one." and then Walter would wink at him if it was okay, and then he'd say, "Oh, that's enough, I don't need to do any more."
That's cool.
Walter was really directing my father as far as his acting performance was in the movie.
You should really try and check the film out on Turner Classic Movies. Every now and then they do show it, and it really is an interesting B-movie, and also kind of fun watching Max Baer fight Primo Carnera on film before they actually fought each other for the heavyweight title. Getting back to Ocean's 11 and Lennox Lewis's involvement in that.
He is training there rather than going to South Africa. He's training for a movie instead of a fight, and the fight is P.S. Haseem Rahman, in which Rahman became the greatest one-hit wonder since Milli Vanilli.
Max Baer Sr. still had quite a Hollywood career even after his fighting days were over, even making films with guys like Abbott and Costello, and hadn't really finished yet with the Primo Carnera story.
As a PS to that, in The Harder They Fall, which is a takeoff on Primo Carnera, Max Baer is the one who knocks him out and knocks him down 11 times in their championship fight.
Next week we'll continue with part two of Hollywood and Boxing with a closer look at the 1957 film The Harder They Fall. We'll talk to Max Baer Jr. about his recollections of his father's role in the film and also talk with the author and screenwriter, Bud Schulberg. The story behind the making of the novel and film, The Harder They Fall, is fascinating in itself. To understand the fiction, let's first take a look at the facts. Primo Carnera, heavyweight champion of the world of the 1930s. Author Bud Schulberg.
In the Carnera story, as I watched it develop with fascination, you knew that Carnera was going to win. You sensed that Carnera was a mob-controlled fighter, really almost a puppet in their hands, and that they were pulling all the strings. It fascinated me. As it happened, we were going to Europe in 1929. Young Stribling was a contender, a pretty good boxer, heavyweight, fought for the title, Paul Charkey, and so forth. Young Stribling and his family were on their way to London to fight this giant that they talked about called Carnera. And so my father and I went to see that fight in London. I was about 14 to 15, I guess. And we knew quite a bit about fights. And we smelled that something was not right in that fight. I think in the first one was a foul in the sixth round. Carnera won. And then they moved on to Paris a month or so later. And we saw the second one in Paris. It was the same thing in reverse. Young Stribling won in on a foul in the sixth round. And my father and I knew from then on, really, that the fix was in for Carnera. It didn't really happen until Carnera came to this country and was really totally controlled by the mob in New York.
The Carnera camp moved to America in 1930. For the next 3 years, Carnera racked up 74 fights and exhibitions, losing only three decisions to Jim Maloney, Larry Gaines, and a 15-round loss to Jack Sharkey. Then came the Ernie Schaff fight, which cemented Carnera's position as a top contender.
Carnera had ostensibly killed pretty good heavyweight fighter Ernie Schaff. Carnera, in spite of his monstrous size, was oddly not much of a puncher. What really had happened is that Max Baer and beaten Schaff very badly, and that Schaff was probably on his way to dying from serious brain damage when he met Carnera.
After the Ernie Schaff fight, Carnera was matched for a title bout against champion Jack Sharkey. Unlike their first contest, Sharkey lost by a six-round knockout, giving Carnera and the mob the heavyweight crown. After two successful defenses, Carnera was then matched against power puncher Max Baer, who bragged to former champion Jack Dempsey that the title would soon be his.
I'm certainly glad to see you looking so well. This far ahead of the fight, and I want to wish you a lot of luck, but stay in good shape and be in there for 15 rounds, because this fight goes 15 rounds, you want to be ready, because this fellow outweighs you 70 pounds, that weight's going to tell on you.
I know it's not going to be a sensational fight like Willard and the Dempsey fight, but I know it's going to end in a knockout. My female intuition tells me I'm going to win, Jack.
Despite Baer's confidence and bravado, the mob wasn't going to take any chances and ensure that Carnera would keep the title. Max Baer Jr.
Dad actually was a 2-1 or 2.5-1 favorite over Carnera, even though he was the challenger, where my dad was actually the favorite. They wanted him to go in the tank. Oney Madden, the gangster from New York, was the guy that owned Carnera, basically. And they came to my dad, wanted to fix the fight before. They came to Ansel Hoffman. Two guys came up to Ansel's suite and had Jerry Casale, Iron Neck, we called him Old Iron Neck. He was my dad's bodyguard. And you got to remember, this is the mid-30s, and this is the days of Jack Legs Diamond and Al Capone and all the other guys. That they'd have thrown Mansell out the window of the hotel if Jerry hadn't have been there. You know, it's just like what happened in the 50s when you had Blinky Palermo and you had Frankie Carbo.
Certainly.
Okay, well, all of those guys, they had, you know, the Don Jordan and the Don Jordan stuff and in Los Angeles with Mickey Cohen and all of that crowd.
Sure.
Well, there was a lot of that stuff.
Despite the threats, it didn't stop Max Baer from knocking Carnera down 11 times, scoring an 11th round TKO, wresting the title away from Primo Carnera and organized crime. It also inspired Bud Schulberg to write the novel and film, The Harder They Fall. In our next chapter, we focus on the book and movie, Humphrey Bogart's last days on a movie set, and some threats Bud received from the boxing intelligentsia and organized crime. In 1947, Bud Schulberg's novel, The Harder They Fall, was released. Despite the fact that it was a work of fiction based on the life of Primo Carnera, many in the fight game and the people who ran it took it as an editorial against the influence of organized crime in the sport of boxing. It would take the United States government, and more specifically a Senate investigative committee headed by Estes Kefauver, another 10 years before they tried to clean up the sport. I asked Bud if he received any threats or flack from the fight world or the mob.
When the center of the sporting world took Shores, which opened shortly after that, yeah, I used that trouble in there in Shores by people cussing me out and kind of threatening me in a way. One claim to fame I have is that Bonnie Ross, the great welterweight champion, he was so infuriated at me when someone, I guess it was Toots, told Bonnie I had written that book. He actually wanted to take me outside. He actually wanted to go ahead and beat me up. People were upset is hardly the word they were.
Not every former champion wanted to beat Bud up after The Harder They Fall came out. Some even liked it, like former heavyweight champion Gene Tunney.
He reviewed The Harder They Fall for the Saturday Review. He reviewed the novel and reviewed it very, very enthusiastically. He said it was the most authentic book ever written on boxing and so forth. And so I did get a chance to thank him for that review. And I also told him I thought it was pretty well written. But in my own case, it got more serious in the book is when I was covering the Basilio-Saxon fight. I think that was 52 or 53, somewhere in there. That fight was clearly fixed for Saxon. And I read a very, very strong piece titled Boxing's Dirty Business Must Be Cleaned Up Now. And I nailed the fight as a total sellout, and that the Cava Bunch were completely controlling the at that time, the welterweights and the middleweights. And next time I went to the Garden, they wouldn't let me in. I was amazed that they even knew who I was, because the writers aren't very well known by their faces. But I was barred from the Garden for some time after that. At that time, I did get threats, phone call threats and stuff like that.
Were you scared? Were you nervous?
I was a little nervous, yeah. But I didn't know what to do about it, so just kept on going.
Did the Kefauver Commission, did you ever have to speak on behalf of them when they did finally investigate the mob influence in boxing?
No, they didn't call me. They did not call me.
Interesting.
The FBI came to see me, oddly, and asked me what more I knew about mob operations in boxing. But the Kefauver did not call me.
Okay. 10 years after the book was made, Columbia made the film.
Yes.
And we've talked about it before a couple times at fights, and I've asked you about it. You did not write the script.
Well, no, it's not quite that, John. More specifically, I liked and actually had worked on the script. And I liked about 85% of the script. I thought they did it very well. But after I got off the picture, I got into a fight with Harry Cohen, the man who ran Columbia Pictures that was making the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I got into a thing with him, and so I was off the picture. And after that, they added two things without my approval, to say the least, that really shook me.
In the film, just as in real life, Toro Molino's status as a true contender is cemented after the death of a fighter, apparently at his hands. The scene in the book and film is based on the real death of Ernie Schaaf, a contender that was beaten to death, apparently in the ring by Primo Carnera, though most experts feel it was a previous beating that he took from Max Baer that caused the real damage.
In the film, they added a scene that was not in my book or in my script, in which Max Baer says that he deserves the credit for that death, not Toro Molino, who was my character in the movie.
You know I'm the one that nailed Gus, murdered him for 15 rounds. Don't know what held him up. But when Gus left the ring that night, he was a dead man. All your Joker did was tap him. I did all the work, and you give your guy all the glory. I don't like it.
Well, I did you a grave injustice. I never knew it meant that much to you.
Well, it does. When I butcher a guy, I want the whole world to know it. And they'll know it when I get through with your boy.
Now, wait a minute. You're supposed to carry Toro for 6 rounds.
Yeah, don't louse up the film rights. That's important money.
Well, there's more than money at stake with me. I'm going to prove when Toro gets in that ring that I'm the guy that put Dundee away.
Now, listen. I don't care what you do to Toro, but use your head. Don't do it until after 6 rounds. That was the deal, buddy. You understand?
No deal, Nick. No deal. I'm going to butcher your guy.
Remember, the film was based on Bud's novel, so he got the credit and in some cases the blame for what came out of the entire picture, even though he didn't write the finished screenplay. A distinction the average moviegoer might miss. Case in point, Max Baer Jr.
In the movie, he played a guy by the name of Buddy Brenner, and Bud wrote him as more of a villain, because in there he was bragging about the killing of the Schaaf guy. I was responsible, not Molina, and I want the credit for it. He was playing the guy, then it was totally unlike him. That was not like my dad at all.
I resented that because I've seen fighters damage other fighters over the years. I had one very good friend of mine in which he, in a sense, killed an opponent and never recovered from it. And my experience was that if fighters have a dread, as a Charles, the same thing with as a killer fighter in Chicago.
Yes.
They have a dread that this might happen. It's the last thing in the world they want to happen. And many, many times they never recover from it. So I resented the fact that they showed up fighters saying that I deserve credit for that death.
The movie also carries the distinction of being Humphrey Bogart's final film performance. Did you know at the time how sick Bogey was when he was making the film?
I did, yes, because I talked to him quite a bit. He came east with the director, and they wanted to go to Stillman's and so forth and walk around the fight scene. And I knew he was pretty ill, yes. I guess I didn't realize he was actually working on his very last film and that the days were short. But I knew he was ill, yes. At the end of the film, they added what I thought was a fortuitous moment in which Humphrey Bogart rolls a piece of blank paper in the typewriter, and he types out the title, The Harder They Fall, and then he types out that boxing must be abolished now. And I caught hell for that because, again, the boxing people naturally assumed that was me writing that. And they were saying, how the hell can you keep going to fight them? I want to abolish him. And I said, Jesus, I don't want to abolish him. I'd like to see him reformed. I'd like to see boxing. The management of it desperately needs to be reformed, yes, but I'm not about to try to abolish boxing. So I wrote a piece for Sports Illustrated. You could look it up, in which I took the movie to task on those two points. But it was not the whole script, John. It was what they did with it, I felt, after I left it. I thought they followed the book quite well. They also took a lot of my script. I thought Mark Robeson, the director, did a very good job on it. I thought the acting stood up well. Bogey was always good. I thought the, what's the name, the big wrestler who played Toro, Mike Lane, that's the name. I thought he did an amazingly sensitive job on it. I was very impressed with him.
And also it was wonderful to see all the fighters, not only Max Baer, but Pat Comiskey.
Yeah, that's right. He was, yeah, and Joe Walcott had lines in it too.
A very significant supporting part is George, yeah.
Yes, he did.
So if you're a Humphrey Bogart fan, if you're an old fighter fan, if you're a Bud Schulberg fan, then The Harder They Fall is definitely for you. The audio sound clip comes courtesy of Columbia Pictures. My thanks to Max Baer Jr. and, of course, Bud Schulberg, who has two interesting projects underway. What Makes Sammy Run, Bud's first novel, is being represented by Random House as part of their 75th anniversary commemorative series and is being made into a 2003 film release starring Ben Stiller.
So there you go. Back to the regular programming on our next episode, which will probably only be hours away. But I wanted to give you guys another taste of some of the things I do on radio, and I thought this would be a good time to do it, yesterday being Boxing Day. Back to the comic book talk on our next episode of Word Balloon. Thanks for listening. John Sutris reminding you to keep tuned to Word Balloon. More episodes coming throughout the end of the year and beyond. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2009.